Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Sean O'Toole. Sean is the founder and CEO of PropertyRadar.com, the only company that tracks every foreclosure in California with daily updates on all foreclosure auctions. Sean is also experienced at flips. He's done over 150 flips, both residential and commercial, and using his extensive background in software industry, he pretty much revolutionized the foreclosure auction process as far as getting information and making it easy. Sean, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we just, right at the end of the last segment, we talked about the holy grail of the affordability index, and we had just touched on the California Association of Realtors. When they refer to affordability, I think one of their phrases is that high affordability is equal to real estate well-being. And I look at that, you know, in other words, the high affordability, let's say at 55% in 2009 and 10, we had to bribe people with an $8,000 tax rebate to want one. I look at it on the other side and say, there is a repetitive theme when you get below 20% that tips over other charts. And your take on it is that it's fairly worthless because it's missing so much pertinent data, as in down payments aren't necessary or neither is qualifying. So, and you know, it's interesting that we all want to come out with the right conclusion, and yet we land in three very different spots.
Yeah, you know, and I certainly understand the history of the Housing Affordability Index and the rest. You know, I think this what we saw in 2007 kind of proves that it's not very useful. And let me do that by stating something that is really super counterintuitive, and this will hopefully help explain why I think it's a poor indicator. I'd suggest that housing was more affordable in 2007 at the very peak of the market than it is today with home prices considerably lower.
Okay, and that's based on what?
So at the end of the day, what affordability is meant to look at, right, is what percentage of households can afford a median price home.
Or, okay, well, wait a minute. Even maybe, and I'm helping you here, not arguing with you. In other words, what you're saying, I think, is very accurate. It's how many households can get a yes answer from a lender. Is that?
I think that's and the way they do that is they take median price, median income, and then they assume a 20% down payment, and they assume the interest rate. So really, the only thing that varies year to year in whether it's CARs or Wells Fargo and NAHB's affordability index, the only variable that really changes is interest rate. Well, interest rate, median income, and median price. Those are the three variables. And those just aren't sufficient when you have, pay option arms and, adjustable rate mortgages and low down payments and changes in qualification and the rest to determine what's affordable and what's not. So again, I'd say more people could have afforded a home in California at the peak of the market in 2007 than can afford a home today.
Okay, and when you say afforded again, not that they could have afforded it, but they would have got a yes answer from a lender. Is that? I want to try to go back there and just make sure.
Let's be clear on what afford means. Afford means being able to make the payment.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
And it doesn't mean being able to make the payment forever. When payments adjust in the future, but the payment at that time. But that's all that it's measuring. It's not measuring, whether it's a good idea to buy a house at $550,000 at 700,
right,
in 2007.
What do you make of the repetitive nature of that, of the affordability chart? I mean, that's the one thing that I look at and say, okay, I can say. And by the way, you had mentioned that in 2007, how did you put it? That it proved that the affordability index was of no use. And I thought it was useful because I could look at that and say, okay, that's the first time ever we went below 17% as a state. So how did we get to 11? And I was able to backtrack into something's up that's never been here before. Oh, no one cares if they loan to people that can't make the payment. So in reverse order, it kind of made me look at it and say, either I'm completely wrong about thinking this is an important chart, or we have a historic nonsense going on that's going to really be damaging. And that's, I guess, where I landed, that I still thought it was of importance, but I didn't realize how many games were being played until I interviewed a lender in front of an audience and asked the stated income number, where does that come from? And she just very blissfully said, oh, we just make it up.
And I guess it was, you know, when I would say it was of no use, as no use as an indicator of what percentage of the population could actually afford a home.
Okay.
Was it useful to you in that it showed, you know, in its absurd numbers that it was completely of no use, you know, probably, right? Because the numbers got so absurd that there was clearly something wrong with it. I don't think there was something wrong with affordability per se. I think there was something wrong with prices and financing and all the rest, but there wasn't really an affordability problem in 2007. If anything, it was the opposite. We'd made homes too affordable, and that drove prices up.
Right, and the chart...
Financing too affordable.
Right, I understand what you're saying. The formula, as it was so inaccurate as to the what was happening in the world. There was the 1%, not the 4% interest. There was no down payment. There were all kinds of other things that played with that. For me, what the affordability chart does, it is the warning system for that tips over other charts. So when that's the usefulness I see at it, see in it. So I look at the repetitive nature of the ending of good times and the starting of poor times. So I go back to 1980, 89. In 05, we got to 17%, which is when I exited a lot of stuff. And the price didn't stop going up until somewhere in 07. And so we went down. So, you know, I guess what I want to ask you, and in all sincerity, is if this is not a valid category, then what is the warning system that you would use, let's say, to say, okay, when this happens, this is going to turn negative?
I think it's on the right track, but without including those other variables, it's really hard to know whether right now at 30% is the same as 11% or the same as 17%, right? Because those numbers fundamentally aren't the same because lending conditions weren't the same at those 3 points. So 30% today might be equivalent to 11% in 2007. And we really don't, that index doesn't really help us with that at all. And so what I'm worried about is saying, well, it hit 11% before, so we've still got a ways to go because it's only at 30. The reality is 30% today could be worse than 11% in 2007.
You know, and I really contemplated that and have said that in front of audiences, you know, that there, and where I went to it, you know, when I wrote that report that in this beginning of the year, I went to that, the concept of reverse stimulus, which was the idea that could this 30% be the new 11? Sure, because if you stop letting people in that you normally let in, and I don't mean normally being 2007, but now, let's say for FHA, what used to be 45% of their business is now 4% of their business. And that's not, it's not normal to be either one. It's not normal to be 45% of their business and a FICO score, you know, less than 600. But it's not normal for it to be 4% either. So you could certainly have restrictive policies that would say, okay, there's no way to sell more houses at 30% affordability because we're just saying no to a lot more people that we used to say yes to. So do you feel that that's one of the big reasons?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this, you know, what is affordable? You know, and what should payments be and what should interest rates be? I think that should be a national conversation, you know, led by, you know, the president and Congress and the rest. To what degree should housing be subsidized? I mean, there's so much focus on getting back to normal. You know, just really top economists writing about, well, you know, we're almost back to normal. You know, and they're saying back to normal is back to 2007 prices. You know, that's back to insanely, stupidly dangerous, not back to normal.
Yeah, and the only reason we're even approaching where we are is we're on the backs of an interest rate that starts with a 3.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you and I know that that's not normal.
That's not normal. So, and maybe it's the new normal, right? There's nothing that says, I mean, you and I, when we went back to Washington, D.C., and we looked at interest rates, I was really surprised to see, you know, advertisements from, I think, early 1900s talking about, you know, you should get into the single-family home rental business because you can get a 5% return on investment. Whereas I think most investors today consider a 7% a good return, even though you can't get it right now in most parts of California. That's kind of our mindset, is 7% is a good return. And here you had an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it had a different name at that time, you know, touting that they could get you a 5% return. You know, so our beliefs on what good returns are and interest rates are, they change over time.
That's, you know, and it's probably changes because of what else is available as investment.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. I felt like I was at a tennis match yesterday watching for the, I don't know, maybe it's the day before, Fed going to change the rates or not change it, but remove the word patient and all that nonsense, you know, to go from a 0.25% to a 0.5% or something. And I just think, man, the year I got into the business of buying properties, it changed 21 times the interest rate, right?
And now they're afraid to change a word about the possibility of it changing.
Right. And the, you know, the market, not that I invest in stocks, but at the moment it was -100. And as soon as the comment came out that we're getting rid of the word patient, but that doesn't mean we're going to be impatient, it went up 200 points. It's just like, that's investing? It drives me crazy.
You know, the stakes are so much higher now, right? We went from a tech bubble to, you know, and they fixed that with a housing bubble, and then they fixed the housing bubble with a sovereign debt bubble. And, you know, all the debt the U.S. has and all the debt, you know, that we're kind of awash in now, the stakes, the little changes in interest rates, the stakes have never been higher. So, you know, I think it's a different world now. I think, you know, and that's one of the things I think maybe we're in just for, to the degree that they can manage this. You know, if they lose control, I think interest rates go up and it's all super ugly. But to the degree that they can manage this, I think they have to manage a world in which interest rates expectations are very low, kind of like in Japan and like their last decade or two now.
Yeah, and I just was reading something where 42% of Japan's tax revenue pays interest right now, and the interest rate is for a 10-year T-bill is 0.2.
Yeah.
Not two. Point two. Yeah.
Point two.
Yeah. So if they had an interest rate double, it would take 84% of their income and the interest rate would be below 1%. That'd be bad. So anyway, okay. I look at charts, and so, and I think people are interested because there are people worried about a correction in price. I'm not one of them, but I can see, you know, that you are. So what?
Oh, no. I think prices should correct, you know, and we'd have a healthier real estate market if they did. And I think they should correct by about 10%, depending on the area, plus or minus.
Okay.
That's very different than I think that they will. I don't think they will, okay, you know, this year.
Okay. Do you think they'll go up? And if so, why?
You know, you know, big picture, everybody's saying, well, sales are down because inventories are down. But, you know, the data actually doesn't show that being true. You know, CAR shows inventories being up, only a little from last year, but up. But yet volumes are still down. You know, volumes last year was the lowest volume, I think, on record outside of 2007. And this year, each month so far, even though last month went up a little bit, is on track to be lower than last year.
Yeah, there's,
and that's not super healthy. You know, it's not good for our economy, and I think having higher sales volumes would be better, and I think lower prices, you know, not substantially lower, but a little bit lower prices would help with that. So I'd like to see it happen, but I don't think it's going to.
Okay.
I think instead we're going to have, you know, sellers looking at the economic data and stuff saying, you know, hey, things are pretty good right now and wages are good and unemployment's good and all this. I don't need to lower my price, and they're going to be pretty sticky on prices. And we've got Airbnb and other things, you know, gobbling up inventory. So there's not a lot of excess inventory. We've got a lot of people kind of stuck in their houses and not wanting to sell and not wanting to move up. So I think we're going to see this year, I think we're going to see lower volume than last year and pretty flat prices.
When I look at charts, especially when I compare them with all the other charts in unison, there's charts that I consider leading indicator charts and reactionary charts. So a reactionary chart would be a trustee sale chart. It doesn't create itself. It's caused by other things, in my opinion. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So I use affordability as a leading indicator because in my study, it looks like, okay, when this kicks off, then it immediately hits this chart and this chart and this chart. So absent affordability, do you have a leading indicator chart that you say, okay, I watch this, and because this tips over, these other charts react?
Yeah, for me, I think the one I look at first and the one that saved me in 05 is volume.
But then you have to get, but at the same time, then you have to ask why. So there's a chart before that that might add to that, no? You're dealing with the reaction, not the event.
But that reaction, right, is I don't know that there's anything that clearly, I get what you're saying, right, as affordability goes down, you know, and less people can afford, volume goes down.
No,
right?
It doesn't. It doesn't. It goes up. That's what you just said is the assumption, but it doesn't. So if you look at volumes, let's say just I'll pick years that I know prices went up, 77 to 79, 86 to 89, 2001 to 2005, volume went up, straight up.
So, but I think if you just dive into that a little bit further, I do a chart on this. So I think what you just said is absolutely true. But if you kind of think about like a clock face with straight up being kind of the peak of the market,
right?
You know, that's when volume's going up and price is going up, right? And before that, you had volume going up with prices flat. And before that, you had price down and volume started going up, but kind of 2008, right? 2008, you had prices dropping and then volume suddenly started skyrocketing. And they started going way up before prices started, you know, to level, and then go way up before prices started to go up. And then next thing that kind of happened is volume flattened out and price kept going up. Then volume went down, kind of, you know, 2013 in the first half of 2014, volume was going down and prices was going up. And then what we've had since the second half of 14 is we've had volume going down and prices flat. And then what comes next is volume down and prices down. And it's just kind of a continuous circle. And then you come back up to your volume flattening and prices still going down, and then volume going up, prices still going down, then
what if
volume
that,
up and prices flat. And it just, that's that kind of circle.
But what if that wasn't how it played out in the 70s, 80s, and 2000? That's what I'm saying, is that this cycle is an anomaly. I don't disagree with anything you're saying as far as this time when you look at volume of sales, doing what you said is done. But if you're trying to say, okay, this is how it always happens, it isn't. So let's say in 92 through 96, you have affordability at hovering at 40% after it got to 17. So was the volume higher in 89 at 17 than in any of those years from 91 to 96? Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, no, the affordability was low. And the volume was high.
I'm not talking about affordability. I'm talking about price and volume, right?
Prices were down from 91 to 96, and volume was down.
Volume hits its peak as price hits its peak.
Okay.
And then volume slows down, and price still goes up a little, and then volume starts to slide, and price still goes up a little. Those phase two and three are pretty short, right? It's just kind of as the laggards kind of come on board. But, you know, I think that's my take on it.
Okay. Well,
We've disagreed before.
Oh, sure. No, and that's because what's so kind of neat is that, you know, we do have a lot of respect for each other. So we're not trying to outdo each other. We're trying to land on a better spot than we both occupy. I guess that would be the best thing that
totally.
We can say.
But I'll go back and look more closely at those earlier periods and, you know, make sure that this. That makes sense. I mean, you may be right.
Well, that's what's fun about charts is that things that make complete sense sometimes are not accurate, and you just go, "Wow, I wouldn't have thought that." That is the fun thing of charts, and you know, when you and I go back to Washington D.C., and the whole purpose is we want to look up 100 years of interest rates, so we know. That's kind of fun to know that we'll both do that. You know, get to the bottom of something without somebody's opinion telling us what it is. So,
yeah, I mean, there's no, one of the things I love about you is, you know, you just, you don't come to it with some baggage of, you know, I need to tell people this.
Exactly.
Let me find the facts to support, you know, what it is I'm trying to say. Instead, you're honest about, boy, I just want to figure out what the data tells me and report that, which is pretty unique in this business because most people are so busy trying to sell something, they only find the facts that support what they're trying to sell.
Yeah, and that's, I'm glad that's not been a temptation, but mostly it's because they have so much money at stake, I have to get it right. I'm not trying to say one thing that's not true because I'll pay for it many times over.
That's a difference in still, I think it's an important difference, right? Is there's people, too many people now. And I think, you know, the way we look at the stock market, so we look at markets overall, and I think this is an endemic problem in this country today, is everybody's willing to trade, you know, tomorrow for today, right? So I won't worry about that thing that's tomorrow in order for today. And I don't know whether we're somehow, you know, children of the Depression or something, but we seem to care more about that long term than just today. At least I really do, and I don't know why, because very few of my friends do.
No, I know it's unusual. I just you're right. I just don't know how to land anywhere else other than what I really believe. And then I would really be hard for me to stand up in front of an audience and just try to manipulate instead of actually, even if it was to my detriment, I'd want to tell them this is what I think.
Yeah.
I really would. We only have a couple more minutes. Under the heading of market makers, do you see either the hedge funds exiting their inventory at some day in the future or foreign investors doing whatever they're going to do? Do you think they're either capable of doing something to the market abruptly?
The hedge funds, I don't really have much concern about doing something abruptly, and we're not seeing any data to indicate that they're exiting in some, you know, uncontrolled way or really at all. So, you know, I have very little concern on that one. You know, I think they went into this knowing that it's not a super liquid asset and that, you know, boy, we've got some problem over here. We'll just sell a bunch of houses to take care of it. So I'm not really concerned about that one at all. I think you have some local markets that have a very big foreign influence. And to the degree that something happens, you know, outside of the U.S., it could have an impact. I'm not an expert in Florida, but I was recently talking to somebody who is an expert in Florida and specifically like Miami condo market.
Right.
And I don't think it was you, but they said there was recently a kind of a big change there because of, you know, Russians were stuffing money into that market to kind of get it out of Russia. But now they've been hit so badly that that's the only money that they have left, so they're having to sell to have something.
Wow.
Therefore, that market is, you know, kind of changed overnight because of that foreign influence. Now, again, I'm not an expert in that market at all, and that was just one person's opinion that they shared with me, but it seems plausible.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the segment, but just to wrap up, there are markets that definitely have more influence, let's say, from the Chinese or Canadian market, that if something would happen to their market, would have an impact. Sean, thanks so much for joining us, and really appreciate your input.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.